I do so love having a little bop along to that cheery little tune, even at this hour. This week, we're off to the famous Cable Beach in Broome, the playground for some very excited kids from the Port Hedland School of the Year. We'll find out about two very different fruits, Mediterranean olives and native Australian finger limes. And I'll introduce you to two old drovers who know a thing or two about mateship.
Well, him and I worked as a team for a long time, you know. We think the same, and we can outthink most people, you know. We outthink the cattle, you know. We never tell one another, we read one another. That's what we call teamwork, you know, and mateship too, you know.
Riding along with Ron Bly and Ted Haberman later in the show. But first stop today, Broome, and a beachside camp for students, staff and parents.
Hello, my name is Tanatasi Valley. I'm from Pumu Community.
And you go to Port Hedland School of the Year, and you're here on camp in Broome at the moment. Now, we're standing on the beach in Broome. How many hours did it take you to get from where you live in Pumu Community to the beach in Broome?
That would be 15 hours altogether.
Is it worth it?
Very.
And you'd want to be having a good time too, if it had taken you that long to get to the beach. Hello, I'm Stephen Stockwell on the famous Cable Beach at Broome in the northwest of Western Australia. And around me are 25 very excited youngsters, their teachers and a couple of parents who've made a long trip to this town from their homes in remote Aboriginal communities and on pastoral stations in the Pilbara. This school camp is one of the few opportunities these distance education kids get to meet up with their friends face to face. And getting to hang out at the beach, well, that's just an added bonus. How often do you get to go to the beach when you live in Punmu?
Not often. We don't have a beach. We only have a really big salt lake called Lake Dora. It's just desert, no beach.
All of your friends who are here with you at Port Hedland School via camp, how far away from them are you usually?
I think I'm the farthest. I'm not very close to them, so that's a bugger. But we still communicate by telephone.
So you still spend just as long chatting to your friends as, you know, most of the kids in the city do?
Yeah.
And is it nice to see them when you come out to stuff like this?
Yeah, we all get giggly and all fun. We plan stuff.
I call this wave surfing. Get the back when this big wave, you jump and ride it and I'm swimming next to a fish.
I'm Darby Stevens from Klein Station.
And Darby, you're here at school camp with Port Hedland School of the Air. What do you like about coming along to camps like this at the beach?
Mainly just playing with my friends, but yeah.
How often do you get to see your mates?
We go to a few camps, about three camps every year, and it's basically the only times I get to see my friends, really. I see them sometimes when I run into them, but yeah, that's basically it.
When you're on the station out at Coolline, how often do you get to go to the beach there?
No, none at all. There's no beach. I go to the river though, which is similar.
As good as the beach though?
Nah.
Hi, I'm Miss Boswell and I'm a teacher at Port Hedland School of the Air. Our kids are just wonderful and it's just such a pleasure. We really love coming to camps. It's pretty much the highlight of the year for us. Spending time with all of them in one big group. Yeah, it's terrific.
It's so better when they're bigger and you go more out. Yeah. I actually swam next to a fish once doing that.
My name's Michael Jennings and I'm principal at Port Hedland School of the Air.
Mr. Jennings, the kids here that you've got at Port Hedland School of the Air come from a really sort of diverse background and a very wide range of places. How important is it that they get to catch up like they do at the camp?
I think it's really important that they have time together where they can spend time with their classmates and their teachers and get that socialisation that they might get if they're in a mainstream environment. And you can also do a lot more things face-to-face that perhaps you can't do online. We also have face-to-face teacher visits as well, so the teachers do go out and visit the children. But the camps are a very important part where the children and their teachers and on this occasion some camp mums can come along and spend some time together doing fun things and also school things.
When I went to school in a mainstream school, if we were going around camp, we'd get a little note that we'd go home with Mum and Dad. Mum and Dad would just drop us at school like we normally would, except with a bag. How much effort goes into arranging the School of the Air kids for a camp?
I guess it's quite a lot, really, but we've sort of done it so many times, we're used to it. For this particular camp, we've got 27 students in Broome. 25 came into Port Hedland under their own steam. So as you interviewed Tassie, I think, that would have taken her 8 or 9 hours through the muddy tracks in from Punmu. And the children from down south, Coolline and Sheila Plains, that would have taken them at about 7 or 8 hours to get into Port Hedland. So that's just the starting point. And then they jump on our bus and come another 7 hours to Broome.
Chris?
Hi, I'm Kylie Stammers. I'm from Coolline Station, and I'm here at Broome on the camp with Port Hedland School of the Air.
And what's your role here at the camp?
We come along as camp mum. We usually send two mums along, mainly just to be a mum for all the kids and clean up after them and give them a cuddle if they need it.
And is there much of a need for a camp mum? The teachers can't take care of them?
Oh, no, the teachers do a really good job, but I suppose we just like to... It's a good excuse to come along, I suppose. It's just nice to know that there's a mum there. Sometimes the kids, being from the station, like to have a mum. They know, because we normally know all the kids pretty well.
And when you come along here, you leave the husband at the station. Can he handle himself? Does he need his own camp mum back there?
Well, after a few years, I suppose they get used to it. They manage to get along on their own for a while.
Well, we got to muster them, then put them on the road as driving. Yeah, we just move them from place to place every day, from camp and water reserves and that, and keep heading them this way, grazing them as we can, trying to settle them down a bit to make them better cattle for competition, for competitors to use, you know. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't.
Walking hundreds of cattle for 4 days along 60 kilometres of old stock routes, roads and through bogs might not be everybody's idea of a good holiday. But it's an annual escape for longtime mates Ted Haberman and Ron Bly in Queensland's North Burnett region, a few hundred kilometres northwest of Brisbane. Hello, I'm Eliza Rogers, and I've caught up with Ted and Ron at the end of their trip in the small town of Mount Perry, where they've offloaded the cattle at the annual Camp Draft competition. This region was devastated by floods earlier this year, and there's lots of cleaning up and rebuilding work still to be done. But that hasn't stopped people like Ted and Ron from taking some time out to go a-droving again.
How many cattle and how many cattlemen?
Roughly 600 head. Sometimes we bring more down, 800 to 900 head sometimes, but this year's a bit light on. It varies. Volunteers come, but Ron and I and a few of the regular fellows, we're just here every year, you know.
Now, why are cattle numbers a bit down this year?
Well, we usually combine two families, two graziers, myself and another fella, but he's not, well, the floods and what we've had here, we shouldn't even be here this year. Should be home, run our own business. But we've got to have a holiday occasionally, so this is our annual holiday.
So this is a holiday, yeah. This hard work. Why do you do this cattle drive?
Well, we like it. That's our lives. We don't know nothing else.
Is it a bit of a chance for you to revisit the past, how things used to be?
Oh, yeah, we tell a lot of...
Chat about it, eh? You know?
We talk a bit of bullshit and about it.
A few tall stories around the campfire?
We talk about these trip snakes we see in this country. You know, if we've got new chummers in the team, we just say, just be careful with snakes here. They'll shove their tail out and trip your horse and they bite you. I don't know, but it's just a tall story, eh? Yeah.
Now, Ronnie, I'll start with you. Now, just tell me a bit of your background. So you're born and bred Eidsvold. Yeah, you're a long-time cattleman.
Yeah, I've been cattle and horses all my life. And I just tripped around everywhere, in Queensland, Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia, I used to go all over the place.
But no place like home?
No, always in the back at home.
Brumbies always come to water, so we always come back, you know.
I knew Ted ever since we used to do a lot of rodeo riding too, and that's how we met, sort of.
And I was always a pickup man. When Ronnie, I was picked up, but I never seen him ever put on the ground with a horse, you know, buck jumper. Very skilled horseman, you know. There was a horse in Motto, he was a bad horse, a bad buck jumper. He'd kill you, smash you into the fence. Ron rode him. He would have killed you.
He was like a real savage horse, he was. You know?
Yeah. He just hated any man on his back. Eh?
So how did you approach that, Ronnie?
No, I just said, well, here I go. I'll ride him. I just said,
yeah. He said, I'll have a crack at him here. He cracked him and rode him out. Eh?
Now, on that point of animal husbandry and horsemanship, we are seeing that die to a certain extent. So how important is something like this drive to keep that alive and to keep those skills up?
Oh, yeah, we got to sort of try things like this to keep it up, you know.
And keep the camp drafting game going. It's just got stronger and bigger, and anyone can come, but we've got to have fellas like this, Ron, to, you know, to back us up. And him and I worked as a team for a long time, you know. We think the same, and we can outthink most people, you know. We outthink the cattle, you know. We never tell one another. We read one another. That's what we call teamwork, you know, and mateship too, you know.
And have you had any issues this year in terms of with the horses or the cattle? Anything go wrong?
No, it's been a pretty good trip, probably one of the best trips yet. Since the flood, the stock routes are gouged out from, well, you know, we had an exercise the other morning that, well, Rod Bettines, he was in the lead. He's been a lead man for many years with us. We hit this bog hole and he went down, and he'd just become our new president here, and I said to Ronnie, looks like we lost our bloody president already.
Is he all right now?
Yeah, he's right. Eh? He's a very tough man, and well, there was 500 head of cattle went into the bog, and they were down to their guts in mud, but we didn't have to get them out. They come back out. And the day before that, we get to Reed's Creek. Well, it's always been known treacherous for quicksand, you know, and you go in there on a horse, but if you let the cattle go, they'll smell where to cross. And I was going to ride across the bridge. I wasn't going to get bogged, because in quicksand, if you jump off your horse to get away from it, they'll keep following you. And if you can't move like us old fellas, or Ronnie's a bit quicker on his feet than me, the horse will come on top of you, you know, jump on top of you, because he's trying to get out and save himself.
So you've been following the stock routes. How badly damaged have they been? What have you noticed this year?
Well, you know, the washouts and the gullies, we had to put them under the bitumen a few times where normally we travel alongside it.
What about traffic? Is that a problem?
There is a little bit,
yeah. There's a problem, but we wear those coats and that, vests.
Pretty good discussion with the main roads, and they gave us a pretty good permit for it. Wear a vest, and we've got a right of way to weigh the traffic down. And actually this year I think we should be film stars, because everywhere most people got out and took photos, you know.
Now, weather's been quite cool. How have the nights been? Had to light a big fire?
No, we got it.
We love our beds. Yeah. And our wives too, you know. Or our women.
I love my bed too. Why sleep out in the cold when there's a lovely warm bed back home? Old drovers Ted Haberman and Ron Bly having a chat with our reporter Eliza Rogers at the Mount Perry Camp Draft. Now on Rural Reporter, we turn our attention to food and two very different fruits. We've got olives from the Mediterranean and native finger limes.
Those are finger limes, and you can see that they are roughly the length and quite often the shape of a finger. They are a native citrus to Australia. They only grow in Australia. They are different to an ordinary lime in that when you cut them open, there are little what we'll call pearls, so that what's inside is a bit like caviar.
The insides of this native rainforest fruit might look like caviar pearls, but it certainly doesn't cost as much. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington in John White's citrus orchard on the outskirts of Wentworth in the southwestern corner of New South Wales. John's always enjoyed pushing the boundaries when it comes to growing citrus, and the finger limes are no exception. He was told they wouldn't grow out here on the banks of the Darling River, but he's proved them wrong, and he's now selling his fruit both locally and into the Melbourne markets.
The colour changes during the season. Start off, they'll be green. Then, as the season progresses, they will tend to go a bit brownish and then reddish. Purple, anything that I've got that's purple is probably over the hill when we throw that out.
How did you end up with finger limes?
Well, we started off growing the CSIRO's blood lime, and they also had two varieties which they thought might have a market potential. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. And I had trees. What would I do with them? There's no point growing fruit that didn't have a home. So I'd heard about finger limes. I'd been told we couldn't grow them here. I thought, I'm going to try.
And try you have. You were getting fruit here. How's the experience been for you?
Look, I've had excellent assistance in various ways, but it's a bit of a challenge. I wouldn't recommend someone going into finger limes with that only source of income.
It's not necessarily a cash crop in that way then.
No, it's hard to get going, but I'm selling some locally. I sell some in Melbourne. I tried this year sending some to Adelaide, but I don't know that that's going to work. I grow more than I can sell. I just have a bit of 3/8 round iron with a hook on the end. I just hook it onto a limb and shake.
With the prickles here, it's quite sharp. Do you feel you have to need to put on a bit of a suit of armour to get in there and to harvest them?
I do have some gloves, elbow-length gloves, but I seldom wear them. At this stage, they come off the tree very easily, and I put catching frames underneath and shake them.
Is this a type of crop that you can manage by yourself, that you can pick it and you can grow the trees without really the need for additional labour?
If you were paying the labour, you would remove the trees.
We're back now, standing next to the back of your ute, and we've got the fruit spread out across here. You're sorting through it. What are you looking for?
The ideal piece of fruit, these days in fruit, big is beautiful, but you look for a fruit which is tight. As it gets older, it tends to get a sort of a square. It's like a pea pod, really. It tends to get square. When you cut one open that is a tight one, the pearls will start coming out under their own volition. And that's why I like to see one that's got a good diameter and that is still round. They don't have a long shelf life, you know, a couple of weeks. I think that's about the best you can do. You can freeze them and they'll keep indefinitely frozen, but when you thaw them, you've got to use them straight away.
Do you have any favourite recipes or tips for people who haven't used a finger lime before that maybe might be interested to give them a crack?
No, I don't. You see, if you can find recipes on eBay, but they're all fancy things that we don't have on our diet. I like them with ice cream. I've tried them with breakfast cereal. I've got to admit, you can live quite well without them, but I'm sure they have some nutritional value. It's one for people to do their own experimenting. I can't offer any solution there.
I might leave you to enjoy your finger limes and ice cream then.
Yeah, well, you see, I did do a bit of experimenting at one stage, and I filled the blender thing in the kitchen, and I filled that with the fruit. Didn't put the top on and switched it on. I got into trouble. So
safe to say there was a little bit of mess.
We've got 650 olive trees, Picheline, arguably the number one table olive in France. And we've also got Lechinos, which is a Tuscan variety. And then being Spanish, I guess I had to go for some Spanish varieties. So I have Picual. And then because I was born in Barcelona, I couldn't help myself. I had to plant Arbequinas.
Angelo Valois grew up on a dairy and tobacco farm in rural Victoria. He's never quite been able to shake off the desire to live on the land. And he's always had a love of olives.
10 years ago we bought this place. We just wanted to recreate a little bit of Europe.
Hello, I'm Lucy Barber, and we're out in Angelo's olive grove near the small town of Bredbow in southeast New South Wales, on the way to the Snowy Mountains. It's gorgeous here today, but it's been really dry over the last few months during the growing season. This means the yield is down, but on the flip side, the quality of the fruit is really, really good. Some larger commercial groves irrigate their trees, but Angelo doesn't bother.
This sort of area, even the Monero, gets on average between 550 and 650 millimetres of rain. Olives require less than 300 millimetres to survive. I mean, obviously, if you've got a dripper system, you can be assured of perhaps higher production levels, but I prefer the intense flavours. And I mean, now in Spain, a lot of the stuff is irrigated, obviously, large commercial estates, but, you know, in my grandfather's village, I mean, you know, trees just survive.
The olive harvest finished here a couple of weeks ago, and it attracts quite a crowd. All their family and friends come along to help hand pick the olives, but Angelo admits he's got a secret weapon when it comes to getting people to work for free.
To be fair, they only come, they tell me, because of my mother's cooking. She comes down from Sydney and she cooks paella, as you would say in English, and they love it. So we put a great big fire and just cook it out on the open flames.
Now, that's obviously a wonderful sharing dish made with rice. And how does she cook it?
Just get some bassa blocks, and you know, we run fires in the home anyway for warmth and heating, so that's what she does. And she's got a great big paella dish, which, for those that haven't or not aware of them, they're like a gold panning dish, and you can get them in various sizes.
So how old's your mum now?
Mum is 82.
And so will she be back next year for the harvest?
Well, I hope so, because otherwise there won't be any pickers. So I'm told. But no, look, it's fun. What we do is we put on a great meal, several hundred bottles of red wine in the house, so there's always wine. No siestas, though. Straight back to work in the afternoon.
Such a beautiful atmosphere out here, isn't it?
Yeah, we absolutely love it. And I shouldn't say working from home, just in case. But
so you've got another job as well as growing the olives?
Yes, I'm a full-time public servant. I'm a toxicologist. I've been selling olives, table olives, in the Snowy Mountains area and also in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And initially we started out with table olives, which is still one of our main areas, but increasingly we're going to turn two of the varieties over to olive oil.
Okay, so we're going into the house now, into the kitchen, and yes, there are olives on the table. Yum.
These are pichelines. The French variety. We do it the old-fashioned way. They basically go into brine, 10% saline, and we don't change the water on a regular basis. We let them sit for about anywhere from 8 to 12 months. And then when they come out of that, we rinse them and we bottle them in a solution that's basically 3/4 brine, 1/4 white vinegar, and a dash of extra virgin olive oil. To some people, an olive is an olive is an olive. The reason we coat them with the extra virgin olive oil is because I just like the feel and the look of them when they've got that shiny look.
It's a lovely silky sort of texture. Can I dive in?
Yeah, you go.
Now, so some of these are darker than others, so that's just a different...
Just the range, because we pick them across a range of colours, you know, so, you know, they will vary.
Oh, they're delicious. They're quite small. Does that affect the flavour?
No, they are a smaller olive. Like a lot of people think of traditional Kalamatis. We were advised that Kalamatis probably wouldn't do that well here.
Well, they're delicious. Thank you.
That's okay. I'll pour some oil for you.
Oh, there's more to come. So you're decanting the olive oil now onto a plate. It's a beautiful, rich, lemony colour with a little hint of green. It's lovely and grassy. Oh, cracking some salt in there. I haven't seen that done before.
Oh, yeah. Only salt. I don't like, I mean, you can have it if you go to restaurants. Balsamic vinegar is very popular. I just love oil on its own or oil with a bit of salt.
Okay, so I dive in.
Yeah, just
okay, break the bread. Bread. Lovely olive bread here. Olive bread, of course. What else? All right. So the salt just sort of accentuates the flavour?
Yeah, I like the taste. And I guess a lot of Spanish cooking has salt. Salt is just a big part of... I know it's not meant to be good for your hypertension, but...
When you talk about salt, Angelo, you get this look of longing on your face.
I do.
Is that a Spanish gene?
Yeah, it's also a as you become a little bit older and you worry about your blood pressure and whatnot, and then you see your mother cook. And the thing about Spanish cooking is because it's got so many other intense flavours, you don't taste the salt. But when you see her put salt on a dish, you know that it's a lot of salt.
Olive grower and salt lover Angelo Valois speaking with Lucy Barber in his olive grove near Bredbow in southeast New South Wales.